Harbor Wall versus Midland Credit Management, appeal number 08-15-17. Mr. Edelman.
May it please the court, counsel. Defendant sent a false statement to Barbara Wall, illustrating using the August 2005 collection letter. It states on the first page that the current balance is $1,181.49. That's okay. On the second page, it purports to give a breakdown of that debt. It states the principal balance is $1,149.09, and it states that the accrued interest is $3,240. Neither of those numbers is correct. In fact, about half the principal balance was interest. All interest accrued prior to purchase was called principal. The accrued interest was only the interest which the defendant added. Neither the principal nor the interest is a correct statement using ordinary lay English terminology. It's also not consistent with the IRS requirements which are applicable in this situation. The IRS requires that a debt buyer, when it either compromises a debt and writes off more than $600 or ceases collection and just discharges it, report either just the principal or the total minus the interest so that the principal can be computed. The defendant's trade associations, the Debt Buyers Association, thought this was too burdensome and filed suit against the IRS to enjoin them from enforcing this requirement, and they lost. The District of Columbia District Court told them the IRS has a right to this information. You stand in the shoes of the original creditor. You compute your principal and interest in exactly the same manner as the original creditor. Get the information, and if it's not available for some reason, look at the contract and give your best estimate. Following that, the defendant's other trade association, the ACA International, American Collectors Association, issued a book which agrees with our position in the IRS. It says, get the same numbers as the original creditor, make the best estimate if you can't get it, and use principal and interest in exactly the same manner as the original creditor. Instead of doing that, Midland goes ahead and issues letters like the one we quoted, misrepresenting the principal and the interest. Now, this court in the Fields versus Wilbur case held that the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is violated when a debt collector misrepresents the constituent parts of a debt. It doesn't, the FDCPA doesn't require that the breakdown be provided, but if the defendant chooses to provide the information, either because of IRS reporting requirements or to facilitate negotiations with the debtor, it has to do so truthfully and accurately. And this breakdown is relevant not merely to the IRS requirement, but to getting the debtor to pay. If somebody like Ms. Wall, who becomes ill and is unable to pay all of her debts, has some money, a likely position they may take is to offer to pay the principal, as that is normally meant, to the creditors. After all, that's the money that they got, that's what they, the goods and services which they received. So they may ask, take that and forgive the interest. I've already paid lots of interest. In fact, during this period, Midland was sending settlement letters, the first letter in the appendix is one of them, offering a discount which, if you take their figure at face value, forgives not merely the interest, but part of the principal. In fact, they were asking for the entire principal and part of the interest. It was a 25% discount, and they wanted $800 and some odd. That would be about $200 or $300 worth of interest, using interest as that is normally meant.
Do we have to overrule that Barnes case to see this situation your way?
Absolutely not. The Barnes case doesn't support the defendants. Barnes involved a totally different factual situation, an unaccelerated debt where they're only dunning for the one or two missed monthly payments. The court went out of its way to emphasize that the letter was clear to the debtor. There was nothing ambiguous. They were not using terms in a manner inconsistent with normal usage. Barnes does not, I submit, stand for the proposition that you can now look at debt collection correspondence from the standpoint of the debt collector. It must be clear, use common English words in their normal sense as understood by the general public. So I don't think Barnes stands for the proposition that you can look at this letter from some sort of debt collector's perspective, and its precise facts are quite distinct. In fact, you can't even justify what the defendant did here by looking at it from the debt collector's perspective. The industry standard is comply with the IRS regulations, comply with what the ACA International Manual says. In other words, do what we contend is required. What Midland does is gain an advantage in dealing with its debtors. It says that the principal amount is one thing. Everyone else in the industry who complies with these pronouncements uses a different set of figures, and Midland gets some advantage compared to debt collectors which don't do this, in other words, the vast majority of the industry. The defendant justifies its position by saying, first, this isn't material, but if it's a subject of an IRS requirement, it's a subject of the debtor slash taxpayer has to account for this on their return. It's a subject of negotiations and settlement offers. Clearly, I think it is material. Defendant also says, well, if you go back and pull your original credit card statements, it would be apparent what is going on. But under the Fields case, this court held that you can't even expect a debtor to go back 8 months and pull records showing what the original debt consisted of. And this Wallace circumstance is exactly illustrative of why you shouldn't. She was paying her debts until she gets a stroke and it becomes disabled and can no longer make her payments. You cannot assume that a person in that situation or any other debtor, because they don't know what the precise facts are, is going to remember what the debt is going to have the statements, or even is going to be the person who is responding to the collection efforts. Often it is a relative, it is a family member, and that family member gets a piece of paper which on its face says that the principal in this case is $1,149.09, and it isn't. In addition to the Barnes case, the defendants rely on the Chue and Taylor cases, which again have very little to do with this case, in fact, nothing. Those cases simply did not present the issue of whether, when a debt collector elects to give principal and interest information about a debt, either because it's required for IRS purposes or for negotiation purposes, does it have to give truthful and accurate information? And my position is simply, yes, the truth is required. If the defendant wanted to use these figures, it could have done so by accurately labeling them. For example, it could have called it the purchased balance or the balance on whatever the date of purchase is, and called the interest, interest that we have added to the purchased balance, or interest at X percent since the appropriate date. It's very easy for them to deal with this truthfully. The vast majority of the debt collection industry deals with it truthfully, and there is really no excuse for them doing this. With respect to the other issues, I'd like to rely on the briefs. I do want to address very briefly the new material that the defendant submitted yesterday. I haven't really had a chance to analyze it, but they seem to be arguing that under some circumstances you can call interest principal. Of the three items submitted, only one is the kind of thing which a layperson would ever look at. It's the last item, and it's perfectly consistent. It says it's either the original principal or what's left unpaid. The other things they cite are an internal mortgage council discussion. Laypersons aren't chargeable with that. And the fact that they have to resort to something like that indicates the uniqueness of their position. And they also cite some other IRS regulation dealing with some kind of sale and leaseback transaction. And I frankly didn't have a chance to analyze it, but it does appear to be the sort of transaction which the average debtor, much less the unsophisticated debtor, will never in their lifetime engage in. And I don't understand why a debtor would be chargeable with anything other than the ordinary meanings of principal and interest. The defendant made representations which are inconsistent with that meaning, and I submit that is a violation of the FDCPA. Unless there are some questions, that concludes my remarks.
Mr. Gottlieb?
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Richard Gottlieb, apologizing for my cold, appearing for defendants, appellants, Midland Credit Management, Encore, and Midland Funding. I want to very briefly address a critical point before I get into my primary argument, and that is a comment that was repeated by Mr. Edelman in his oral argument. In his presentation, he discusses the letters at issue, the Dunning letters at issue, the statements at issue, as though in each instance my clients used the term principal. They used the term principal balance. The reason why the 28J was submitted was because we have a situation here where there is a unique distinction between principal and principal balance. They are understood terms. It's very much like the litigation that went on for years in the firm offer of credit litigation. Mr. Edelman's firm and other plaintiffs' firms continued to argue that a firm offer of credit was like an offer under contract law. And this court in Cole versus U.S. Capital said no. Firm offer is a federal term. It may be undefined, but we look at federal law to determine what firm offer means. Here, Mr. Edelman today, and again in his briefs, argues that we use the term principal. Well, principal is part of the term, but the term that was used was principal balance, and I think it's a significant distinction. The other thing he said today, which is new and not in the briefs, is that somehow there was an industry standard as a result of an ACA unattached document that relates to how debt buyers report debt to the IRS through a 1099-C. That is not something that establishes industry standard. And I submit there's nothing in the record, nothing at all, to suggest that at any time there was an industry standard as to how these things are to be, these debts are to be reported. A third thing he mentions, and it comes up the first time in the reply brief, and I want to make sure the court is clear on this, is that his position now is that somehow there is an obligation to report the amount of interest on the underlying debt. There is nothing in the statute that requires that. The statute, the FDCPA, at section 809A1 says you have to list the amount of the debt. In fact, contrary to the position that Mr. Edelman is making this morning, in his own brief, he says at page 23 of his opening brief that we could have complied by not providing any breakdown, which I submit might even be more confusing a result than any other, because what it would lead to is a situation where you'd have the underlying debt, you'd have the interest accruing since that time, and no disclosure of the fact that there was additional accruing interest. And if anything, the decision upon which he relies the most, the Fields versus Wilbur Law Firm case, would teach that you can't do that. If you're going to add a charge to a underlying debt, disclose it. And that is precisely what happened here. And we should look at the four communications. They're in the record, short appendix, pages 16 to 21. Each of them were absolutely clear. The first letter, February 3rd, 05, identifies, that's short appendix, page 16. Couldn't be more clear. It says, we are a new company out here that we're going to try to collect on this debt. We purchased it from British Petroleum. It identifies the debt collector. It identifies the purchaser. It identifies the amount. And it has all the statutory requirements about debt validation. In contrast to the position being asserted today, the debtor received, this is in her transcript, in her deposition transcript, she received this note. She had 30 days to challenge the validity of that underlying debt. She did not do so. Everything that happened after that, the attempts to collect on that 1149, that's valid and appropriate under the FDCPA. But she didn't challenge it within those 30 days. So the idea that somehow we had an obligation to disclose the underlying interest is belied by that fact, and it's belied by the fact that the statute only requires that you provide the total amount of the debt, and that's in Section 809A1 or 1692G, and not the interest and principal on the underlying debt. The second letter, also in the short appendix, at page 18 of the short appendix, is the kind of letter that Mr. Edelman does not challenge. It's a straight request for the principal and interest. The third and fourth letters are the ones he challenges the most, and the most that, again, are impeccably accurate in every detail. And they're at short appendix 19 and short appendix 20. You have there clear statements that there's a principal balance from the underlying debt of 114909. Couldn't be more clear, read in conjunction with these other letters that she's been receiving, you know, in a short time period in 2005. Makes it pretty clear this is the underlying debt that was acquired from British Petroleum. And in each case, the April 15 letter, the August 27 statement, you have clear statements, accurate statements of the amounts due. You have accurate and clear statements of the underlying principal balance, never described, as Mr. Edelman would call it, as principal balance, ascribed to British Petroleum in every instance, and ascribing the amount of the accrued interest. Exactly as Fields versus Wilbur Law Firm would have us do. Exactly the kind of interpretation that an unsophisticated consumer is expected to have. They're expected to have rudimentary knowledge of financial statements. They're supposed to not interpret things in the bizarre and idiosyncratic fashion that Mr. Edelman now wants to preach, that somehow principal balance means principal, and that somehow we should ignore the fact that we have four statements that couldn't be more clear, couldn't be more accurate, couldn't be more true. And let's talk about Barnes. I think you would, Judge Evans, have to overturn the Barnes case to reach the result that is being attempted here. The Barnes case is a case in which, as a bottom line, a plaintiff came in and argued, never mind what, you know, the clarity of this particular statement, it hyper-technically violates the FDCPA because it doesn't state the total amount due. And the court said, wait a minute. We need to analyze this from the standpoint of the relationship of the debt collector to the borrower, and not the underlying creditor, rather the debt collector to the borrower. And applying that exact analysis in Barnes, the court said, no, we're not going to look at the total amount due. It's the amount being sought by that debt collector. That's the only thing that matters. In that case, there was no requirement that they had to specify the interest or principal or any other component parts of the underlying debt. Of course not. The statute doesn't require it. It would only be more confusing to impose such an obligation. Applying that, at least three judges, we've got Judge Castillo in this case, in the underlying case, you've got Judge Barker, in the Southern District of Indiana, you've got Judge Dara here in the Northern District, and there may be others out there that the Edelman case is bringing. You know, they've brought several of these lawsuits, where you have rulings by district judges, none inconsistent with Judge Castillo, saying the way we interpret Barnes is you look at it from the standpoint of the collector to the borrower, and in this case, in those circumstances, that initial amount listed, whether listed as amount due, whether listed even as principal in one of those cases, or as listed as principal balance as here, which I would suggest is the accurate term, that is correct because that's how the debt collector would view it. They're the ones that were either assigned that debt or purchased that debt. It's the capitalized principal balance for them. And that's how they're looking at it. They were assigned this debt. If there's something in addition that is going to be accrued beyond that, that needs to be listed. Again, consistent with Fields versus Wilbur. Now, I want to point out, because it's very important for the court to recognize the inconsistencies of their position. Their position is, in essence, that once you disclose the accrued interest, you better damn well also disclose the interest on the underlying debt. Let me explain why that would even lead to that would lead to total confusion. In the initial letter, they were obligated to disclose only the 1149.09. That's all the FDCPA requires. But the moment that there is going to be accrued interest, Mr. Edelman would have debt collectors break down the 1149.09 into, say, 738.07 and, you know, 402.99, whatever the numbers add up to, which would create confusion. Now you're confused. Now suddenly the debt borrower is seeing a later communication where it doesn't match the first, is seeing a situation where you now have potentially accrued interest that is after the fact accrued interest being added on to the underlying interest, and that could lead to confusion. And in the Barnes case and in other cases, this court has decried any scenario where the requested result would be more confusing and therefore frustrate the purposes of the FDCPA. I also want to talk about materiality. Now, I don't think this is false in the least bit, but and therefore we don't have to reach the question of materiality. But even if this court were to assume for a moment that this is somehow material, and I don't think it is, Congress has spoken on the subject. We've already covered it. Section 809A1 of the statute, 1692GA1, says there's no requirement to break it down. So the entire argument that somehow a debtor may be less likely to pay the interest or only would want to pay the principal, that's inconsistent with congressional intent. If Congress thought it was necessary and important and prudent and necessary and material for a borrower to see the interest amounts, the principal amounts, it would have specified in the statute. It didn't. So therefore, we know right now on materiality that that issue is not material. It's not material. It shouldn't be deemed material. It's statutorily deemed not material to a borrower. And further, there are no cases that consider this principal interest breakdown as material. They've never been able to point to one. None exist, and everything they do point to is inconsistent. They cite to and rely upon, both in the briefs and in the argument this morning, to the Fields versus Wilbur Law Firm. First of all, that case is not a materiality issue. That's a case where a law firm tacked on an additional amount as attorney's fees and didn't disclose it. That's not this situation here. It's not even close. The idea that somehow it would be material to borrowers because of the of trade association materials, that's pure nonsense. That would make it material to the debt buyer because the debt buyer needs to know that information, but internal reporting is not an issue here. How they report eventually a charged-off debt to even to a borrower is not the issue here. It's whether it would be material to a borrower to understand how much of their debt was principal and how much of their debt was interest, and the answer is there's none. Finally, I want to address very, very briefly the question of debt collector status. I don't think we ever get there. But to the extent the briefs argue that somehow an entity that is a parent company could somehow be liable as, you know, for a particular FDCPA violation merely as a parent, that's a ludicrous concept. What they're trying to get this court to do in its ruling, rather than simply remanding for the issue, is to have the court issue an opinion on a subject this court has never extended out as far as they would like. The closest case they cite to is a case called Schutz versus Arrow Financial. That's a case where Arrow owned the debt, Arrow retained a debt collector, and then the debt collector committed violations. Here, they're trying to go after the ultimate parent company, a no-employee ultimate parent company that did not own the debt at the time this debt was assigned, did not hire the debt collector, had no participation, and trying to suggest that Encore could be liable for this FDCPA violation. To the extent this court ever even reached that point and it had decided to reverse, let the district court decide it. But to the extent the court even thinks about going, you know, discussing that issue, that is an unwarranted extension on the FDCPA. I have nothing further unless the court has any questions. Thank you very much.
Mr. Edelman.
Your Honors, I believe that we have been very consistent in our position. The FDCPA does not require that the constituent portions of a debt be disclosed. There is no claim of a 1692G violation in this case. However, if a debt collector elects to provide information about what the debt is, it has to do so accurately, truthfully, and correctly. It didn't do that. The term principal balance contains the word principal. It simply means the unpaid portion of the principal. That, I think, is its plain English meaning. If, as counsel suggested, you want to look at what federal law says principal balance means, I suggest the IRS reporting requirements which apply to this very situation and which require the use of the same term as the original creditor would use in reporting the information. There is no explicit materiality requirement in the FDCPA. The statute prohibits, and this Court has held that it prohibits, any false statement by a debt collector. The only mention of materiality in this Court's decisions is the Every versus RGM case, where there is a comment, there might also be a case in which a false or deceptive statement clearly was immaterial. And they cite a case, the Court cites a case involving the use of a trade name as opposed to the proper corporate name of a debt owner. Where the issue in question is relevant to negotiation of the debt and is the subject of an IRS reporting requirement which ultimately results in either tax liability for the debtor or the debtor having to explain to the IRS why they do not have tax liability, it is material. It affects the decisions of the debtor in paying the debt or not paying the debt. I just do not see the materiality aspect. As for inconsistency, if you allow what Midland has done in this case, ultimately its debtors will get two different statements referring to principal. One is the IRS 1099, which uses the word principal the way I suggest it has to be used. The other is theirs. It doesn't make any sense to allow that. If Midland wants to provide information about the amount of the debt it purchased or the interest which it added to the debt, it can do so. It just has to use accurate and truthful labels for those numbers. As indicated, it could use the term the balance we purchased, the balance on a date, the interest we have added, the interest since a date, but it cannot use the terms principal and interest without any qualification to describe those components. With respect to the industry standard, the ACA is the main industry trade association. What we cited was a published book. It's publicly available, and it says compute principal and interest the way we suggest. They, again, did not have to provide the information, but if they elected to do so for whatever reason, they had to do it correctly, and that they did not do. Barnes. Barnes, I do not believe, can stand for the proposition that you look at communications from the standpoint of the debt collector and allow a debt collector to use language which is not consistent with ordinary English. Barnes involved an unaccelerated credit card. The debt collector was only trying to collect one or two monthly payments. The amount it demanded was $200 on a $10,000 debt. This Court held that the FDCPA does not compel the acceleration of debts. That would be silly. It does not require that the large amount be stated. Rather, it is sufficient for 1692G purposes to state the amount of the two monthly payments the collector is trying to collect and clearly label them. That simply does not justify what was done in this case. Unless Your Honors have some questions, that concludes my argument.
We'll take this case under advisement, proceed then to the third case on the